This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Morning of the Grill. I'm talking to Nicholas Kaur, the Director of Research and Economist at Khazanah National, as well as Tyler Kok. He's the Head of Tax for Malaysia at KPMG. And both gentlemen, you're on for a panel discussion on Budget 2020, which is due to be announced later this afternoon. Now, let's start with Bersatu's 10-year plan for shared prosperity by the year 2030. It's going to be the latest incarnation of the new economic model. And the Shared Prosperity Vision envisages real GDP growth of 4.7% in the 10-year period of 2030, a nominal GDP of 3.4 trillion ringgits in 2030, compensation of employees at 48% of GDP, and SMEs and microbusinesses to be about half the economy by then. And of course, Bumi enterprises at 20% of national income, and income of not less than 5,800 ringgit a month for the bottom B40 group, which is a lot. So Nick, let's start with you. Now, let's get your points of view on the shared prosperity vision in terms of the achievability and perhaps the Budget 2020's early salvos at trying to achieve these high ambitions.
Thanks. First of all, thanks for having me here. And I should add that these views are my own. I'm here personally, not as representative of Khazanah National. But thank you for the question. I think the first thing is that the Shared Prosperity Vision is a Pakatan Harapan one, not just a Bersatu one. And it's meant to be an overarching guiding policy for some of the initiatives that are set to come about this year, next year. So the first real way that we see this is this year's budget. But next year, there's the 12th Malaysia Plan and the new Industrial Master Plan. And all those should feed into the execution of the Shared Prosperity Vision. So for the Shared Prosperity Vision, I think it is a way of consolidating a lot of what the politicians have been saying over the last year and a half. And I think something the markets have been crying out for is a guiding document for where this country is going to go, as set by the current politicians. So this provides some of that. The question is then on the execution. And we'll see some of that in the budget, but also more, I think, next year, the 12th Malaysia Plan, because I think YB Dato Sri Azmin is in charge of implementing it. And also then in the new Industrial Master Plan for MITI. But for the budget today, I expect some work on industrialization. There's been a lot of talk on premature industrialization in the news. I think the minister, Lim Guan Eng, mentioned it recently. And I think the budget will fit quite a lot of that into it. It's a way to try and drive Malaysia towards a more high-value-added economy. As for the targets, there's this whole nominal real thing that's going on out there now. But I think the growth targets are one thing, but what we should be more focused on, and ultimately what I think is more important, is the structure of the economy, whether we can actually successfully reform towards a more high-value-added economy.
Ty, from a tax perspective, what's KPMG's view on what we can expect later this afternoon?
Thanks, Chuang. I think we should be expecting some offerings for the SME sector. That has been a traditional focus of the past budgets. We've always had introductions of new measures to assist the SMEs. And after all, SMEs are a large portion of Malaysian business. So I think that there should be some focus there. Question is, which angles are it going to come in the form of? We've had assistance insofar as the reductions in chargeable incomes for a lot of the SME entities. That's already been done. That's still in place. Should there be some more assistance insofar as perhaps from a non-tax angle, looking towards microfinancing initiatives? A lot of SMEs who are struggling to get funding, and without funding, they're not going to be able to contribute and increase their businesses. So microfunding in some way. Alternatives obviously could be to extend the incentives available to them insofar as their expansionary activities are concerned. We've got restrictions insofar as some of the incentives for expansion. Looking into that particular area may be something that it's going to be very useful. There is very, very little motivation to continue expanding when you are in a situation whereby you're pressed. to perform and to succeed. So assistance to the SME sector, I think, will be something that will be looked at.
Well, the perennial discussion is whether GST should make a return or not versus SST. And at this point in time, we don't know, except the suggestions from government sources is that GST won't return. But at least from a conceptual standpoint, Nick, what's your opinion? Should GST make a return?
So I think in general, whether GST returns in the form that it was in before or in some other form, I do think that a consumption tax is very important. And in fact, I think a consumption tax, again, this is my personal opinion, is actually preferable to most types of income and wealth taxes. The reason is it's a choice decision. You know, you can choose what you want to consume. Whether it should return in the previous form at 6% or some other percent, or whether it, it's you exempt some things or not. I'm not sure that at the moment the political situation is ripe for such a thing. I mean, it's kind of meaningless a little bit if to discuss this very much if there is no real support for it on the ground. And if there's no support for it on the ground, it seems that, a return to the GST is pretty unlikely anyway.
What's the tax leader's view on this, Tai?
I think that conceptually, GST is a much more efficient mechanism. At the end of the day, we talk about government revenues. GST is obviously proven to bring in much more revenues to the government. I guess the records show 40 plus billion versus 20 plus billion in so far as SST. Of course, the 40 plus billion was inclusive of amounts that have not been refunded to the public yet. But nevertheless, it is a much more efficient system. It encourages compliance. But of course, at the end of the day, the public pays for the tax. So whether it should be back or not, I think it is, as I said, a much more efficient system. It perhaps is a system that everyone will go to at some point of time. Nick correctly pointed out that consumption taxes are perhaps much better than direct taxes. Whether it should be at that rate is a different matter. Whether there should be certain mechanisms that are put in place or separate programs that the government will put in place to assist the B40 sector when it comes to this form of tax is something to be looked at, because obviously the idea behind such a consumption tax is you use, you pay. But obviously, the B40 sector also uses and also pays. So is this something that there should be some support for? How do we make sure that they are not worse off? But the other point, I guess, about a GST-type mechanism is this user pay thing. There are a lot of people who actually don't pay tax. There are a lot of people who have never filed tax returns, who have never paid a cent of tax, but in a consumption tax situation, you use, you pay. So they will end up catching these people into the tax net, if you like.
Well, that's the issue, because I think it's reasonably well settled among urbanites and professionals like yourselves that the GST conceptually is a superior tax in terms of its broad-based versus a sales and service tax. But that's the conundrum, Nick, because you corrected me in saying that it's not a Bersatu plan, it's a Pakatan plan. And even then, it is a political manifesto at the end of the day because of where it sits on the proposition chain. We had on the grill a few days ago Ideas on one side as an independent public policy think tank, and we also had Masa, the Bersatu think tank, and it was clear where the dichotomy lied. And that's the conundrum, because as an economist, you know the difference between what is good for the country versus what is politically feasible for the country. So this is posed an impasse, in your opinion, for the country's development going forward.
Well, I think it's actually a mistake to assume that we live in a first best world where you can have the best policies and the best everything, the most technically sound things. Because the truth is, economic policy, by definition, has to also be something that is politically supportable, one, and two, implementable. And at the present, you know, if the SST versus the GST, and I agree that the GST is generally a more efficient tax, but if you can have a first best technical policy, which can't be politically supportable and can't be implementable, then it's actually pretty ineffective as a policy in general. So I think we should appreciate that we live in, you know, not a first best kind of thing where, we have every single greatest policy in the world sort of thing. But realistically, we need something that can actually be passed through Parliament, and we need something that is actually implementable. And right now, I think, and right now, and to be fair, I hear your point. I just think that that's true, not just for the GST, but for any other policy that we can imagine.
Okay, I've got Nick Grill, the economist and director of research from Khazanah National, Nick Kaur, as well as Tyler Kok, the head of tax for Malaysia at KPMG. Well, of course, both of us and three of us were having a panel discussion on the Budget 2020, which is due to be announced later this afternoon. We're going to be coming back with some of the nitty-gritty in terms of the tax mechanisms in this country. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
I have on the grill with us the economist and director of research for Khazanah National, Nicholas Kaur, and Tyler Kok, head of tax for Malaysia at KPMG. We are discussing Budget 2020. And of course, Nick, you are speaking as an independent economist at this point in time. Let's discuss the IDEA's proposal for a return of GST, though at a lower rate, but then also to have fresh indirect taxes to mitigate shortfalls, like a progressive CGT, capital gains tax as well. Ty, from your point of view, I'm sure you've seen some of these ideas in some incarnation. What's your point of view on this proposal?
If the proposal is to basically bring back a GST in one form or another at a lower rate, I think that proposal would be something that, from a revenue standpoint and from a public affordability standpoint, will be good. We still need to have a system whereby the cost of doing business does not go up. The old system, if you like, does have an impact on cascading tax, which is not beneficial for a business. And therefore, that GST mechanism, which allows for an input tax credit system, will basically assist businesses. I think I've had many conversations with a lot of businesses, and to be fair, on the onset of GST, they were extremely skeptical. They were, to a certain extent, some of them were terrified. But having had GST for a couple of years, they got used to the fact that this is basically a mechanism insofar as to tax consumption, and they got more and more comfortable with it. And then when SSD came back, they were all jumping up and down again and saying, "Look, I don't like this. I prefer that." You know. So I think the idea of reintroduction of a form of GST is useful at a lower rate, but there are going to be certain mechanisms that must be put in place. The promises of refunds that are due to taxpayers must be fulfilled. If it is a situation whereby when we had GST 1.0 and whilst the collection mechanism was great, the refund mechanism was extremely slow. That is what that will put the entire business sector, up in arms against any reintroduction.
Yeah, so Nick, I mean, like it or not, GST was used as a political message in the last elections, and less power to the economy as a result. But, The sheer weight of numbers around the world in terms of the use of consumption taxes is inarguable. And I think even Japan at 10%, they've just raised theirs as well over a number of years, of course. We might eventually get there, the reintroduction of GST. I think most urbanites suggest that might happen. What do you think the public or the wider mass majority in Malaysia want to see before that can happen in terms of the feasibility of its reintroduction?
That's a great question. I think, you know, one of the things that we can see, at least from the numbers, is that the GST collection, a lot more efficient, a lot higher, in fact, of course, than the SST for the government. But I think before we can get the majority of Malaysians to turn around and say, hey, maybe the GST system isn't so bad, I think they kind of need to see the effect on them. So we're increasing these taxes. Have public services improved? Is education getting better? Are we getting better healthcare? Those kinds of things need to be felt. That's the positive way of looking at it. There's actually a whole strand of literature in economics that shows that people need to see things get very bad very fast before they're willing to accept a new idea. This has happened historically, right? Whether it's in China or in the Meiji Restoration and the Ottoman Empire. So these kinds of things historically needed something very negative to happen first. But of course, we don't want that. So the opposite is we do need to show and we need to to demonstrate that, hey, if this GST is going to come back, how does it impact people on the street? How does it impact the services that we receive on the ground, rather than just some, government revenues are higher. We get more people in the taxes, because more people obviously would like to avoid paying taxes than get on the taxes. So, but the thing is, I actually believe that if you pay taxes but you get a decent service in return, people are okay. And I think maybe once we start getting people to recognize, or the other way around, once the government starts to recognize that people need to see these improvements, then only the ecosystem is set up for a return to a GST.
It's the Budget 2020 panel before the announcement officially later this afternoon, and I've got Nicholas Kaur from Khazanah and Tai Lai Kok from KPMG discussing the issue. Now, of course, Tai, a part of the idea's proposal was to see the introduction of a progressive capital gains tax made on, for example, the disposal of assets like company disposals, mergers, acquisitions. This is, I think, some kind of effect where it reins in speculation when the economy is stagnating and encouraging investment to leave their money in the markets when things are good. Did you see that? And what do you think of that in terms of the possibility of it being introduced?
Okay. I guess as most people know, Malaysia has real property gains tax and not CGT at the moment. Capital gains tax basically applies on the disposal of any kind of capital assets. So it could be houses, properties, your cars.
In a way, it's a rich tax as well, right?
Which is also
politically feasible.
In a sense, yes. So if you talk about such a CGT, then really it's the guys who can afford to buy capital items, capital goods, I guess to a certain extent can also afford to pay if they do derive any gains as a result of acquiring and disposing these assets. It's possibly going to be, the question of how much revenue can be obtained from such a new tax is a question mark, obviously. And of course, the other point would be, how do you go about insofar as administering and execution of the tax? The quantities that are... Well, there were also suggestions of, if you like, things like wealth tax.
Inheritance taxes and
stuff like that. So there was a lot of talk, or rather there was a lot of discussion about the possibilities of introducing things like this. Personally, we did have a look at wealth tax for a while, and the research that we did for wealth tax basically showed that there was very little revenue as a result of the introduction. It can't be too high, because if it's too high, people will leave the country. And the administration was going to be extremely cumbersome for the revenue. So wealth tax was really not terribly feasible, though it was thought about. But CGT seems to be a much more relevant and accessible tax, if you like, for purposes of revenue generation. But we do need to look at the administration. What kinds of capital items are we talking about? Are we just talking about luxury goods? Are we talking about your day-to-day stuff? Insofar as your day-to-day stuff for businesses are concerned, there is a form of tax, if you like, when you dispose of your capital assets. But obviously, I think the focus should be towards luxury goods. And if you talk about luxury goods, what, cars above 1.5 litres? Your normal day-to-day use things? There's a lot of things to think about, and you're going to have a huge amount of administration involved with this.
What I understand from Budget 2019, Nick, is that tax revenue was about 74% of income for the country. The rest of it came from non-tax sources, including Petronas dividends. What do you think might move the needle, other than, for example, the non-politically feasible GST introduction? And if wealth taxes are not going to work, then what might move the needle?
So I think we're unlikely to see the kind of Petronas dividends that we saw last year that Petronas paid to the government. I think what might move the needle is actually in the longer term. I don't necessarily know. Okay, so in the short term, I think there'll be a lot on actually collection. Can we actually improve the efficiency of our collection such that we get more income taxes and more corporate taxes? So that's something I think they'll look at.
Some might say that the collection has actually been so vigorous that it's been uncomfortable.
Sure. But if you're going to move the needle, I think you have to make people uncomfortable, right? And I don't know if there is a way to be comfortable, but also collecting the most tax you can get.
Well, at least anecdotally, people are saying that some of the measures to collect tax has been almost unfair, because even though people have declared sources where officially in the past, they have still come back the island revenue and still asked for more taxes.
Sure, and I think part of it is really to kind of make up some of the previous taxes that were uncollected. Maybe things like closing tax loopholes could work. But I think in general, over the long term, what we should maybe want to consider, and this is, again, a personal view, is, you know, you mentioned about IDEA's proposal on a progressive capital gains tax. I think the issue with that is that those who can afford it will just move their money elsewhere. Capital is mobile. So, you know, your collection itself will be a problem. Something a bit more grounded, and I've argued this before, writing in The Edge, that something like a progressive consumption tax might make sense. If you think about it, we're already kind of doing it, right? Like when you have cigarettes and alcohol that's taxed at a different price than, say, a Kit Kat bar, you're already making a choice on the progressive consumption tax. Of course, I think how we do it is another matter. India tried to do it with different types of tax rates for different goods. That didn't work out so well. Something a bit better, you know, something that I've seen before, at least proposed, is you take someone's income at the start of the year, somehow you get their savings. I mean, it requires a lot of data in there. You and then from that, you can subtract and get the consumption for the year, and you tax that on a progressive basis. I think if this is my, again, personal view, if GST were to return, we may want to consider a progressive consumption tax.
I'm talking this morning to Nicholas Kaur. He's the Director of Research and Economist at Khazanah National, albeit speaking in an independent capacity this morning. And Tyler Kok, he's the Head of Tax for Malaysia at KPMG. We are talking with two gentlemen, the Head of the Budget 2020, which is due to be announced later this afternoon. We're going to come back after the news, gentlemen, and we're going to basically get into some of those issues, whether it's in personal taxes, whether it's a reform of the SST regime, and also some of the other corollary taxes like digital taxes. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the grill this morning, I've got Nicholas Kaur, the economist and director of research at Khazanah National, and Tyler Kok, head of tax for Malaysia at KPMG. And we're both, all three of us, talking for an extended panel discussion on Budget 2020, due to be announced later this month. In fact, later this afternoon. Now, in January, it was announced that Malaysia's gross direct tax collection for 2018 was at a record 137 billion ringgit. Ty, how do you reckon 2019 will fare in comparison?
Thanks, Chuang. What we've heard, obviously, is that we should be able to achieve the targeted revenue collections of 150 billion by the end of 2019. That's a very impressive increase by any means. So and I would only suggest that in this afternoon's budget announcements, we're likely going to be seeing a projected target. Another projected targeted increase in revenue collections. So it'll be new records being set insofar as the Indian revenue is concerned. So I think insofar as the
where do you think the number will be?
I think that if I were to, I would be speculating if I were to give a number, but certainly 150 if reachable this year, and the various plans that the revenue may have in place insofar as ways and means in which to increase the revenue base, I would suggest that perhaps we could easily be looking at 160.
So why all this hand-wringing over GST versus SST when actually year after year, at least in the last 2 years, collections are at a record?
Well, obviously, we have to take note of the fact that insofar as government revenues are concerned, all the taxes are basically play a part, whether it's direct taxes in the form of income tax, individual income tax, corporate income taxes, petroleum income tax, and indirect taxes in the form of the SST now, import duties and excess duties and stuff like that. So all these taxes play a part, and it has always been a situation whereby the economy has been growing. National finances have been growing, and they've been growing as a direct result of the ability to fund. And if we didn't have GST, and SST basically gives us say 30-40% less revenues insofar as indirect tax is concerned, then that necessarily means that we will have to cut down expenditures. Of course, I will defer to Nick on that, but we will have to cut down expenditures, either that or increase our borrowings. I believe that our debt financing costs amount to something like 10% or more of the budget. That is a huge amount.
Yeah, I mean, it's a trillion ringgit and about a deficit of what, 3.4 to 3.8% in terms of where the range sits.
So the revenues are absolutely necessary. So question is, where do you get those revenues from?
Correct. So although Lim Guan Eng has said there'll be no new taxes in Budget 2020, we know that the tax on digital services will come into effect January next year, Nick. And I couldn't help but notice your column in The Edge last week, which suggested that Malaysia is not quite ready for a knowledge economy, because that typically is preceded by job losses in terms of people not being qualified or capable of doing, you know, things in the new economy, whether it's in IoT or whether it's in big data or whether it's in artificial intelligence. What's your view on the knowledge economy and our desires to get there?
Thanks. First, thanks for reading the article. Usually it's only my mom and my wife who reads the article, so I appreciate that you read it. So I think, actually, I did ask the question, you know, just are we ready for a real innovation-based economy? Because if you look at the type of technologies that kind of generate the industrial revolutions. So you have the steam engine in the original industrial revolution, which is a labor-replacing type of innovation. You get to the 20th century, and in America, a lot of it, the computerization, just the machinization, sorry, not computerization just yet, is labor-augmenting, meaning they help people stay in their jobs, but they improve the productivity. The kind of technology we're looking at now, which is automation, AI, which is still to come. AI is still, I think, pretty far away. But automation and, in time, AI is actually labor replacing. So just as a society, are we actually ready to have, you know, a churn in job losses and things like that? Because I think one thing we've seen, so Carl Benedict Frey, who wrote a great book on this called The Technology Trap, shows that these kinds of technologies can only happen once you have political support for it. And the Industrial Revolution in Britain, it happened because they needed to fight other nation states. They could, so they needed to actually mechanize and that sort of thing. But now, if we are looking at something like, you know, protecting jobs and so on, it doesn't necessarily jive with the kind of technology we have now. Of course, we could look at labor augmenting technology for now. But in truth, innovation actually requires what Schumpeter called creative destruction. And I think some part of that is needed. It doesn't obviously have to be as gloom and doom as everyone thinks, but a healthy churn is needed. And I'm not quite sure whether as a society we're prepared for that, whether it's in our culture, whether, I mean, attitudes, social norms, and even our laws and regulations.
Well, at least from a top-down perspective, we see that the government is making all these sounds. And, you know, even the imposition of a digital tax indicates that there is a desire to go there. But at the same time, Tai, the OECD, I think in the last few days, has suggested a global approach to digital taxes. I think in totality, first of all, in your opinion, how much of an input can a digital tax, you know, offer to the system? And secondly, to what extent does the government have to tread the balance between discouraging investment in the sector versus income for the coffers?
Okay. I think that we have the digital tax, as you correctly pointed out, being introduced beginning of next year. The digital tax, well, very simply, is a situation whereby you want to be able to tax businesses who provide their services digitally to consumers in Malaysia or to businesses in Malaysia. Now, is that a good idea? If we would think about it, there are not very many countries in the world that have a digital tax. A lot of countries are talking about it. A lot of countries are thinking about it. The likes of all your tech giants who basically pay little or no tax is in the papers every single day. Public outcry is there, especially where they have got operations and earning billions of dollars, but pay virtually no tax. So I think it's there, it's good. Whether or not the OECD is going to come up with a framework for taxing the digital economy, it's on the cards, it's coming out. Question is, who is going to adopt, who is going to comply, who's not? Malaysia has basically said, look, I'm going ahead. I'm not going to wait for you guys to decide what you want to do. I'm going ahead with this. And I think the only problem, I guess, insofar as the introduction of this tax is the ability to manage, the ability to execute, the ability to administer when a lot of these entities are in foreign countries. But nevertheless, it is a situation whereby they are required by Malaysian law to register, to account for, and to pay the tax. So I don't really have much of an issue with such a tax. It makes sense to me that these people who are providing services in Malaysia do contribute to the economy in Malaysia in the form of taxes. So to me, that's fine. In the area of digitization, I think it's something that really, are we ready? Perhaps not. Do we need to do it? Absolutely. Question is, if we were to wait and get ourselves ready, are we going to be too late? Are we going to fall behind everybody else who is on the particular digitization bandwagon? We do need to innovate. I think most businesses feel that true need, and those who fail to recognize that, unfortunately, will end up facing the consequences.
We have on the grill this morning the extended Budget 2020 panel discussion. Nicholas Kaur, the economist and director of research for Khazanah National, and of course Tyler Kauk, head of tax for Malaysia at KPMG. And we are having an extended discussion on Budget 2020 due to be announced later this afternoon. Now, knowledge economy, digital economy notwithstanding, there is a whole swath of the population which are considered to be in the B40 segment in terms of their living conditions and economic conditions. Budget 2020 should be a budget for these people to uplift and to reduce the income disparity between them and the middle classes and the top classes. And Nick, what do you think is available in terms of strategies for the government to close this gap?
Great. I just want to highlight there's a recent study by the Khazanah Research Institute, which was published maybe a few weeks ago, and actually a better demarcation for how we should think of the B40, because they're not all the same. And one of the findings is that the B20 are the ones who are only generally able to afford basic necessities. So the basic necessities are, you know, they have to buy the food, whatever, and those kinds of things we should support by, you know, things like the Bantan Sari Hidup and so on. But for those above that, we should think about economic empowerment. How can we help them, you know, upskill, how we can help them get ready for more innovation in a more digital-based economy. So I think the kind of measures that you do should actually be less broad-based, but a lot more targeted on your audience, because there's no point, you know, giving more handouts or whatever to people who actually want to upskill. They're not looking for more money. They're actually looking for a long-term higher NPV by getting a better job and so on. So economic empowerment matters for, say, those who are above the B20, but below B20, for those who really need it, we should still continue to support.
Gentlemen, it's time for some messages, but we'll be coming back after this, and we're going to be discussing the B40 as well as the subsidy segment, BFM 89.9. Nicholas Kaur, the economist at Khazanah National, and Tyler Kauk, head of tax for Malaysia at KPMG, are both on hand to discuss Budget 2020 due to be released later this afternoon. Now, we last left it, gentlemen, at the B40 segment in terms of what measures the government can do to address their plight and to reduce the income disparity between them and the middle classes. Ty, first of all, for you, what do you think, what ammo do you think the government has in their sleeve? And secondly, in terms of subsidies, which is another form of uplift, what is your opinion on that?
Okay, I think insofar as the B40 is concerned, the Bantuan Sara Hidup obviously is still there. Looks like it will continue to be there. The position insofar as subsidies and payments like this, personally, I do not think that it is something that's sustainable. You do want to support, but you do want to support in the right way. And the question is, how do you support in the right way? Upskilling them, giving them opportunities to enhance themselves and to be able to make a better or create a better outcome for themselves. The problem with payments like this is that it becomes an expectation. It becomes something that I don't have to do anything and I'm entitled to this, so do I need to do anything more? Do I have to do much, much more for myself? There will be those few who will still try to break out, but the rest will be trapped in this particular position whereby they are continuously waiting and hoping for this assistance. Nick probably can perhaps give a more educated economist's view on this, but that personally is my thought. we need to think about something else in order to lift them to a better place. I mean, we're talking about from B40 to the high B40 or B20 and stuff like that. So what do we do about that? So the fuel subsidies, I believe, that are being introduced again this time round, I understand, are a bit more targeted, and I think that's much better rather than the current situation whereby you just set the base price for your RON95s and all that. So to me, it's an improvement, obviously, but the question is, can we do much more insofar as getting rid of the mindset of subsidies, introducing more measures insofar as creating capabilities of the public?
Well, good point. The petrol subsidies are much more targeted this time around, but I think Professor K.S. Jomo is right in pointing out that most of the B40s do not have a vehicle, they do not have a car, they do not even have a motorcycle in some cases. So where that money should have gone instead is into public transport. Now, what are your views on that, Nick?
I 100% agree with that. I think last year when they introduced the 100 ringgit flat public transport for the urban area, for KL, actually greater KL area, I think that was a good move. And I think more towards public transport is important, not just because of cost of living issues, but also because just it's better for the environment, better for our roads, and generally a more positive kind of move towards actually, in a way, spreading out the density at the centre as well. Not in terms of economic density, but in terms of like the housing prices and spreading some of that outwards as well. So I 100% agree with that.
What about basic living conditions and cost of living issues? And this is an issue not just for the B40s, but for the middle classes as well. A lot of people say that a combined household income of 8,000 ringgit is not enough for KL, and that sounds crazy compared to, say, 10 years ago.
Well, I think... I don't want to argue with people who feel this way because they are the ones living through it. So I'm not here to tell them, no, you're not feeling that way. But I think short-term measures for a problem like this are not going to go very far eventually because subsidies are obviously the first target you do, but how sustainable are they? I think a more longer-term thing, and, you know, the budget can always lay the foundation of this. The budget is always a one-year document, but it can lay the foundation of actually building a more competitive economy by reversing premature deindustrialization and moving our economy to produce more complex, more sophisticated goods and services. So I think that, you know, if we keep on focusing on cost of living on a short-term basis, we're missing actually the real thing, which is actually wage growth. Because cost of living ultimately, you know, if something costs 1 ringgit but I make 50 cents, doesn't matter. Something costs 5 ringgit but I earn 10 ringgit, that's good. So ultimately, we care about purchasing power, we care about income growth, and we care about compensation. But I think the overly focused on short-term cost of living as a means to generate long-term keeping prices down is a bit short-sighted. Of course, we need to mitigate, you know, like oil shocks and things like that that can happen every now and then and to ease a little bit, but it shouldn't be part of any long-term solution. Long-term solution is really in growth and creating competitiveness.
Well, in Malaysia, it's always about the transition, right? We want to get to someplace, but there's always that bridge to get there. Ideas, Tai, suggested that there could be a living wage tax credit. So basically, minimum wages to be raised higher, much higher above the minimum wage of whatever it is, 1,100 ringgit, to say 2,500 to 3,000 ringgit. And if you do that, then you get a corporate tax reduction on a tiered basis. Do you think that there is a role for the corporate sector to play in terms of, basically bridging the gap between the haves and the have-nots?
Okay, this may be a personal view, but I think this appears to be a very artificial way of pushing the envelope, if you like. Let's make sure everybody's minimum wage goes up, and for that, I'll give you a corporate tax credit deduction, whatever you want to call it. At the end of the day, I'm still going back to what Nick was saying. Look, we have to have a productive economy. We have to have a productive society. If by artificially shifting things around like this, it doesn't really help anyone. Just like if you're talking about keeping cost of living low, again, artificially suppressing what it is that the market actually is and what the market actually requires.
Okay, so gentlemen, we've got 2 minutes left. I'm going to give you each of you 60 seconds to tell us your wish list. Not just for you personally, but also for your respective institutions of employment. What's on your wish list for Budget 2020? Nick?
I think in general, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about trying to build economic competitiveness for the country by thinking about how we can incentivize and in fact, in create ways to invest in more high value added, more producing more complex exportable goods and services. I think if we can do that, we can get the economy in a long track for the long run, solve a lot of the problems when it comes to wage growth, productivity, as well as the cost of living. So my main wish list is, if we can find a way to reverse premature deindustrialization, or at least lay the foundations for doing that, and then increase the sophistication of our goods services, that for me is something I'll be really looking out for.
Tai?
Okay, my wish list, number one, SMEs, I think we need to have something that helps the SMEs insofar as doing business is concerned. It could be tax incentives. It could be fiscal, assistance to the SMEs. I think that is one critical thing that we have to think about. We talked a lot about the B40. I think we should also think about a little bit about the M40. Okay, the M40 has been largely neglected because obviously the B40 has created great concerns, but the M40 equally is finding things not as rosy as they would like, and given their lifestyle, tough. And really, finally, a thought about the issue of, I guess, we have to close it with a bang, isn't it? SST versus GST. Much, much more study needs to be done insofar as how to make sure that whatever system that we end up with is a system that is effective and responsible to the public in large.
Okay, well, Nicholas Kaw, economist and director of research for Khazanah Nasional, and Tai Lai Kok, head of tax for Malaysia. Thank you both for your views.
Thank you.
And
thank
of course,
you very
we're
much.
Discussing
Thanks
Budget 2020
me.
Later to be announced this afternoon. BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, Frost & Sullivan's Malaysia Mobile Service Provider of the Year.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.